Genesis 33, verse 1. No, I'm fine. Yeah, just spluttering. Genesis 33, verse 1. Jacob looked up, and there was Esau coming with his 400 men. Jacob looked up, and there was Esau. So we've had two big ideas this week. We've been thinking about relationships, how important they are, and how they can go wrong through our idolatry, how they can be kept healthy and restored through forgiveness. Then we've talked about the one relationship with God and how central that is. So we've talked about how God is speaking to us, just like he spoke to Jacob. And then last, I'm forgetting my own series, but anyway, we talked about that for a while. Now, what I want to do today for the last thing is to try and tie it together. And I want us to see there's a link between God and our relationship with God and our relationship to other people. I want us to see, I want to tie it together. You know, so you see it here. That's why I've picked verse 33, chapter 33, verse 1, because by the end of Genesis 32, Jacob is right with God. But of course, Esau is still coming. And everything he's been terrified about for the last 20 years is still there. And he's still got to be faced. So the question I'm going to ask really is, well, how does being right with God help us face our Esau's, help us face our other relationships and even other difficult things in our lives? So that's where we're going. We're trying to integrate the two. And I want to help us to see that it's really important. The knowing God makes a difference when it comes to facing Esau. Right, I have two things to say. First thing is, actually being right with God is foundational for all our relationships. In fact, foundational for the whole of life. That's the first thing I want to say. And that's why we read from Genesis 3. So in Genesis chapter 2, there's the world that God created before sin entered, before the fall. And it's a perfect world. And it's a world full of perfect relationships. Could you imagine that? There's a perfect relationship between God and humanity. There's a perfect relationship between humanity and humanity, Adam and Eve. There's a perfect relationship with humanity and ourselves. You know, they're naked and they're not worried about that. They're at peace. There's a perfect relationship between humanity and nature. You know, all the different angles, all the different relationships, they're all whole. They're all in harmony. But what happens in Genesis 3, of course, is that they are broken. So the relationship between God and Adam is broken because of Adam's sin. And the relationship between Adam and Eve is broken. They're all blaming each other for what's happened. The relationship between Adam and his own self is broken. Because now they're ashamed and they try to cover themselves up, no longer at peace with themselves. And even the relationship with nature is broken. It's now going to be by the sweat of their brow that they exist. But what I want you to notice is the order. The relationship with God is the central one. And it's when that is broken that all the others fracture. And so my point is really that there in Genesis 3, the relationship with God is not just one in a list. It's the key relationship. It's the foundational relationship. Now, about 10 years ago, we had to put a room in our loft because we had too many kids. And we had to go into the loft. So we had to sleep in the loft. And it's don't tell anyone, but we didn't do it to building rags. And you keep bumping your head. And it's hot in the summer. It's cold in the winter. It's just recorded. Okay. Okay. Well, that's a joke, obviously, just for the record. That's not true. Completely meets all building regulations. But anyway, when they were doing it, these cowboy people came in to do it. And they, the first thing he said was, right, we've got to take out, we've got to take out the queen beam. I'd never heard of a queen beam, so okay, take out the queen beam, fine. And he says, the trouble is, the whole thing might fall down. Because apparently the queen beam is the queen beam. It's the key thing. And that's the thing that's holding it all together. So they were very anxious to do it quickly. And I was anxious they did it quickly as well. But that was the thing that was supporting the rest of the roof. I don't know how it works. But anyway, my point is, our relationship with God is the queen beam, right? That's the thing that everything else depends on. And if that is wrong, then frankly everything else is going to be wrong. Everything else is going to be unstable. But if that is put right, then that makes it possible actually for everything else to be put right. So you had to do that beam first. And then once that was right, you could do the rest. Or we could try a different picture if we're not interested in lofts. You go to a doctor. We've got a few medical students here, so forgive me. But you go to the doctor, and you go to the doctor, say you've got pain in your ear, and you go to the doctor, say, my ear hurts. He goes, so he looks in your ear, he goes, yes, your ear does hurt. Yes, I told you that. Yes, my ear hurts. So he checks that out first, and then they start asking you questions. And I went to a doctor once about something, which you don't need to know about. And he wanted to know, did I have very hot showers? I'm thinking, what does that relate to what I just mentioned? It seems kind of, you say I've got pain in the ear. And he goes, okay, how's your big toe? I go, it's okay. Yeah, it's fine. Are you eating plenty of vegetables? I go, what's that got to do with a pain in my ear? And when you go to a doctor, they ask you a load of random questions that don't seem to relate to... Now, why do they do that? Well, the reason they do that, I think, is because they know that the pain in the ear might just be a symptom of some deeper disease. And they're doctors, so they've spent thousands of pounds getting an education so that they know what the other symptoms of it might be. So they know that actually there might be some disease whereby your right ear hurts and your big toe hurts. So that's why they ask you about the big toe, or that there might be a link between that and having a hot shower, or whatever it is. So what I'm trying to say is this. There's a difference between the symptoms, which is what we feel, and the actual disease, which we might be completely unaware of. But the doctor, because they're educated, knows how to fish for that, knows how to look for that, knows how to ask for that. Now, it's like that with our relationships. You know, we are conscious of the pain in the ear, or usually a pain in the neck. This person that's difficult, this relationship that's a challenge. Or we find that it's difficult for us to do this, or to face that, or face the other. We're conscious of that. But actually, that's only ever a symptom. The disease is always our relationship with God. That's the foundational thing. So all of our brokenness, all of our difficulties, all of our broken relationships, they're only symptoms. And it's our relationship with God that is the disease. And actually, you can just focus on the symptoms. So you could just take the painkillers for the pain in the neck. And that'll help a little bit. But unless you address the foundational issue, the disease, the relationship with God, actually nothing really is ever fundamentally going to change. So how does being right with God here affect my other relationships? Well, actually it's foundational, because that's the relationship. If that's right, then we can trust for the rest, and we can look for God to work in the rest. That's foundational. And that's what Jacob's finding here. Jacob is right with God. He's still got to face Esau, but now Esau comes and he discovers something wonderful. He discovers that actually God has also been dealing with Esau. And there's a reconciliation. So that's the first point. Right with God is foundational. Second point, that was a bit of theology, in case you didn't know. Now, the second point is a bit of psychology, really, but biblical psychology. And the second point is that being right with God is actually transformational in our relationship. It's foundational for our relationships, but secondly, it's transformational of our relationships. Now, here I want to say, try and reach for how being right with God helps us be right with other people. So I'm just trying to go for that, really. What does the fact I'm right with God do that helps me in my other relationships? So what does it do? So now, before we start, I've got to say, it's like becoming a Christian is not like a silver bullet. So you know, now I'm a Christian, everything's going to be fine. So becoming a Christian doesn't solve every Esau. I'm not saying to you that, you know, you become a Christian or you're right with God, then actually God will have dealt with everything in your life and, you know, all the Esau's are going to run and embrace you. That's not going to happen. But it might happen sometimes. I think it's right to pray for it. That's another issue. But being right with God does give us some powerful resources that help us in our relationship. So I want to talk about this, and I've got four things. Okay. So being right with God, how does that help me in my relationships with others? How does it transform them? Well, first thing is, if I'm right with God, that means I am secure first. I'm a secure person. If you're right with God, you're secure. Now, this really matters to human beings. Okay, we have a deep need to be accepted. Every single one of us. We need to belong. It's a deep need. And so what it means is that actually we're always alert to this. We're always looking for some approval. We're always looking for some verdict on us. We how am I doing? What do they think of me? Is it okay? Is it all right? And I said we're talking about psychology, but actually I think this is a piece of theology as well. It's deeper. Because actually I think we are hardwired to do that. I think it's part of being in the image of God. I think it's part of our creation. It's part of what it is to be a human being, is that we need a verdict. And I discovered this in a sermon I heard online. I thought it was really helpful. This guy pointed out that in Genesis 1 and 2, as God creates, God is constantly giving a verdict. He's constantly saying, it is good. He's constantly approving what he's doing. So he makes this and God looks at it and he says, it is good. And he makes this, it is good. He makes men and women, he says, it is good. There's a constant approving, there's a constant affirming from God that is being given to creation and to human beings as part of creation constantly and repeatedly. But of course, what happens in Genesis 3 is we sin and we lose the approval of God. And instead of blessing, now there is cursing. So God no longer looks at us and says, it is good. No longer. Even though we're still his creation, but we're in his creation in rebellion. So he doesn't look now and say, it is good. And this sermon I was listening to, and I think it holds water. I think it's really helpful, in fact. He said, the point was, that's the origin of our insecurity. That we've lost the ultimate approval of God that we need as part of his creation. We've lost it because of our sin. And so we're just trying to compensate from that now by getting the approval of other people. So we're sort of needy. We need people to approve us to somehow make up for our loss of this verdict from God. So we can't live without this approval. So we're constantly seeking it. And so the hidden assumption in all our relationships is love me, accept me, approve me, tell me I did okay. Now, if that's there, and if that's a motive in all of our relationships, that puts quite a lot of pressure on a relationship, doesn't it? Because actually, I need you to be telling me how well I'm doing. I need you to be telling me everything's okay. I need to be reassured. But you become a Christian, you get right with God, you go through the Jacob experience, you meet with him, you put your trust in Christ. And what's happened? What's the New Testament's way of describing that? Well, and the Old Testament, but what's the way of describing that? We say you have been justified. Now, justification is a legal word, and it means that we've received a positive verdict. It means that we've been told we're accepted, we're approved. In other words, we're back in Genesis 1 and 2. God is now looking at us and saying, it is good. We're getting the verdict that we need. We're getting it again, the verdict. It's being given. Now, that's tremendous. And that, if you can get it, if you can embrace it, that is going to change you at a deep, deep level. And it's going to give you a security which is robust. Doesn't mean you're never going to, like, need people to be approving of you. Of course you are. It doesn't mean you're not going to care if people are horrible to you. Of course you are. But it does mean that everybody else's opinion is actually relativized. So it's nice to be praised. It's nice to be approved. You still need that. And it's still not nice to be criticized. And it's still horrible to be rejected. But now I know that none of that is ultimate. Now I know that underneath that, I have a much bigger verdict from a higher court. And that verdict is approved and accepted. So although in the lower courts of my friendship group and my peer group and my culture, I might being rejected, I'm not being as affirmed as I'd like to be, I know that in the ultimate court of heaven, of God, that there is a total acceptance, there is a justification verdict that's gone. So that's the first thing that getting right with God helps us with in our relationships. It gives us a security. And so actually, relationships don't need to be about me so much. I'm a bit freer now. I can risk a few things in this relationship. I can be a bit more honest. I can be a bit more real with people. And, well, that's the first thing. All right, second thing. I said there was four, remember? Second point, four sub-points. Right, first one was, right with God makes you secure. Second thing, right with God means you are free. Now, we hear a lot about freedom in our culture. This is the Tim Keller book plug. Okay, next point. We hear a lot about freedom in our culture. And what our culture means when it talks about freedom is freedom to focus on what I want. Freedom to focus on myself. And this is massive in our culture. And it's really important that we don't just breathe this in without noticing. It's really important that we are self-conscious and aware that this is part of the worldview we live in and aware that it needs to be challenged. Because if you're not aware of this, you're just sucking this in. That's like breathing in exhaust fumes every day. Like there's a street in, was it in Newport? Probably was. It's the most polluted street in the whole of Wales, and it's in the news at the moment. They're all complaining about, I can't stand living here anymore. It's actually near Caerphilly. I remembered. Sorry, people from Newport. Sorry for people from Caerphilly also, but it's not my problem. What am I trying to say? What I'm trying to say is, if it's like living with all those exhaust fumes. You know, you need to be aware they're there, otherwise you're just going to breathe them in and pay the price. It's like that with our culture. So we need to know that when our culture talks about freedom, it's got a certain definition of freedom. And the definition is free to focus on myself. Our culture tells us that personal fulfillment is everything, and personal fulfillment is about doing your thing. And you must be free to write your own story. You must be free to create your own identity. And you mustn't be bound by anything outside of you, by any person, by anybody's rules, by anybody else's story, anybody else's identity. You are meant to be free. That's what it means. And it is the only absolute in our culture. You must have this kind of freedom. Your happiness depends on it. Now, one of the things we've learned this week, if we haven't learned it before, is that actually that sort of freedom doesn't deliver. We had the guys from the True Freedom Trust, and David mentioned it. That community, which sort of epitomizes this definition of freedom, actually you check out their own websites, and you find that there's an awful lot of brokenness there. So we talked about that. Now, we should be thinking about that quite deeply. Do you want to know why the community that is most focused on doing your own thing is the most broken? Maybe not the most broken, but is broken. Do you want to know why? Well, because that thing about freedom, our definition of freedom, our culture's definition of freedom is a lie. It's wrong. It's not true. It doesn't fit with reality. And it's a disaster. Because that the only relationship that view of freedom can give you is a relationship with yourself. That's the only relationship it can give you. And everybody else you think you're relating to, you're not relating to them. You're only using them as a mirror. You're only using them to focus more on yourself. They have got to be there to fulfill your dreams. They are there to meet your needs. It's a consumer relationship. Do you remember from a few days ago? That's the only type of relationship that can function where you've got that view of freedom. Because people have got to give you stuff. They're there for you. You're always at the center. Now, the real freedom that we need as human beings is actually the freedom of self-forgetfulness. Not to be totally turning everything in on myself so that everything's a mirror, but the freedom of self-forgetfulness. That's what we need. And I remember reading something from John Piper, and he points this out. He says, you know, what are the greatest moments of joy? They are always the moments of self-forgetfulness. And he's obviously been to the Grand Canyon, because he talks about the Grand Canyon and the joy of being captivated by the grandeur of the Grand Canyon. And he says, that's a moment. You're not thinking about yourself. You've forgotten yourself. You are captivated by something bigger and greater and more beautiful. And actually, you read the Bible and you find that this obsession with ourselves is a profound sickness. It's what sin is. Sin is curving in upon yourself. Sin is trying to put yourself at the center of the universe, trying to make everything revolve around you. And it's a hopeless task, because nothing's going to revolve around you. Nothing. And you're just dooming yourself to frustration and exhaustion and collision in the end. Okay. But you get right with God now. You get right with God. What happens? Well, you have that Copernican revolution of the soul. Copernicus, do you remember him? He was the guy that realized that actually, what did he realize? He realized that the earth goes around the sun, thank you. Rather, I hate to get that wrong on tape. The earth goes around the sun rather than the sun going around the earth. Now, we are all pre-Copernican in our sin. We think the world revolves around us. We think the sun is going around us. We think everything's going around us. When you become a Christian, you have this moment of realization that actually we're just a tiny speck, and actually we're in orbit around God. He's the great center of gravity. And that's the reality. And it's absolutely ridiculous for a tiny speck in the cosmos to be trying to get all the galaxies to circle around it. We just don't have the gravitational field. We're just not big enough. We don't have the pull. Now, becoming a Christian is that you suddenly realize, hang on a minute, it's not about me. It's not about me. And our culture says, oh, that's terrible. But you know, when you become a Christian, you realize that's wonderful. That's wonderful. And you can forget about yourself and you're captivated by something much greater than the Grand Canyon. You're finally dazzled by the right thing. You're dazzled by God himself. That's why the Psalms are full of statements of worship. So Psalm 27, I'll just give you this one. One thing I ask of the Lord. What would it be? One thing I ask of the Lord. This is what I seek. What is it? Well, the psalmist says, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life. You want to go to church every day? Why? Well, to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord and to seek him in his temple. You see, there's somebody who is forgetful of themselves. Yeah, I'm quite happy. I don't care what happens, as long as I can see him. And that's where human beings are meant to be. And that opens up a whole world of possibilities as God works through us, when we're forgetful of ourselves, when we're dazzled with him. And of course, you apply that to our relationships, and that takes huge pressure off them. Because actually now, I don't need you to make much of me. I don't need you to be constantly smoothing my ego, telling me how wonderful I am. I don't need that anymore. It's not my goal anymore. That's not what the relationship's about anymore. I've been set free from that. Instead, well, do you know what? We could talk about you. I can ask you some questions. I can listen to you. I'm interested now in you. And I can forget myself. And I'm interested in God. He's my identity. He's my life. And that's all been dealt with. That's all secure. I don't have to fight for this anymore. He's my dreams being fulfilled. He's my fulfillment. I don't have to become this amazing thing anymore and everyone to be dazzled by me. I can just forget myself. Because God is everything. I'm nothing. He loves me. I don't know why, but he does. Nothing can change that. I'm in him. I'm with him. I've got capacity to care about you. That's the second thing. So right with God is transformational, because right with God means we're secure. Right with God means we're free. Third thing now, broadening it out a little bit. Right with God means we have courage. Or I'll put it another way, means that we're no longer dominated and controlled by our fear. So back to Jacob. Remember him? Okay. Now he's terrified of Esau. And he's terrified of what might be coming. And fear is a very powerful thing. If you're scared, that's normal, okay? You're not weak. That's completely normal. It's a product of our fallenness. We live in fear. It's a powerful thing. And here's Jacob, you know, he has a promise from God saying everything will be okay. I'll bring you safely back home. God has said that to him. And he's still gripped by fear. Yeah, and maybe you know a bit about that. Maybe that's how you feel as you're contemplating going home tomorrow. Maybe. Or what's coming in September. Maybe. Most people do. Now, my point here is, look how knowing God changes that. Now, it doesn't take away the fear. That's disappointing, but true. I don't think Jacob is suddenly unafraid of the fact that he might about to be getting slaughtered. But what's happened is the fear is no longer on the throne. The fear is no longer in control. So I think knowing God doesn't necessarily take away fear, but it tames it. Why? Well, because you know that God is bigger than what we fear and bigger than our fear itself. See, what Jacob knows is having met God, he knows that this God really is in control. And he knows that this God is big enough to be in control, to be safe. He knows this. And he knows that God has a purpose. He's now met God, and he knows that this purpose is good, and he knows this purpose is wonderful. And so he knows that actually, ultimately, whatever happens here, he is safe. However this is going to pan out, however this is going to work out, he is safe. That's something knowing God gives you. It takes fear off the throne. It displaces it with God himself, with the fear of God, if you like. A bigger fear, a better fear, a cleaner fear, a good fear. Another thing this passage emphasizes is that actually God uses our fears. So God here uses Jacob's fear to do something wonderful. God uses Jacob's fear to bring him to an end of himself and to bring him to God. I don't think Jacob would ever have come if he hadn't been cornered like this, with Esau bearing down upon him. Jacob was too resourceful. It was his fear that brought him. That's an interesting thing, isn't it? God uses things. And I do think that knowing God, another point, does bring courage. Courage to make relationships, to put yourself out of a comfort zone. Courage even to risk relationships by telling the truth in love. And let's be clear that courage is not the absence of fear. Courage is doing the right thing even though you're terrified. See? So courage, nobody's absent of fear. Nobody has no fear. Courage is doing it anyway, even though you're terrified. And in fact, I'll go a bit further. Fear, I think, and other people think, seems to have quite a key role in ministry generally. I got a friend who's a missionary, a church planter in Ireland, and it's James Masters, and I'll never forget one of his prayer letters that came back. And in it, he said, the first rule of Christian ministry, if it doesn't scare you to death, it's probably not worth doing. And I like that. I'm not saying I've lived by it, but I like that. It's true, isn't it? God wants us to get out of the boat. Walk on water. Now, that's a scary thought. And there's people in this room I know have done that. And they're walking on water. Wow, terrifying. If it doesn't scare you to death, it probably isn't worth doing. And I suppose another thing to emphasize is that God does actually use our weakness, our failures, just as much as our successes. This is sort of despicable, isn't it? Oh, Jacob terrified, you know, sort it out, Jacob, man up, Jacob. But no, this stuff is significant. Let me run to the fourth thing then, which picks up on that. The last thing is that if you're right with God, you've got a resilience in your relationships. Why? Well, you know that God has a plan. Just like Jacob here, he knew God has a plan. God had given him a promise. He was part of this covenant, the God of your fathers. God has a plan. We know this. In fact, we know more about it than Jacob did, because we've seen much more of the plan unfold. We've seen God come down. We've seen God become flesh. We've seen God taking our sins upon his own shoulders and paying for them. We've seen Christ then returning to heaven and the Holy Spirit coming down into the world. We've seen that. You know, we know much more about the plan. We've seen the church. We see the gospel for all nations, translatable into every language, every culture. We see that. We've had thousands more years to see God's faithfulness, see this plan unfolding. We've seen that. Now, that gives you resilience. He's proven himself time and time and time again. He's not failed anyone ever. He's not going to fail you. We know God is with us when you know God. You know he's with you. That gives you resilience. See, Jacob knew God was with him. He's got this Bethel thing. He's got the promise. And of course, we know more than Jacob. Again, same points. We know the incarnation. We know that God has come down and is with us. We haven't got a Bethel. We haven't got a temple. We don't have any sacred place. Every place is a sacred place. We have a sacred person. We have Jesus. He is the way. He's the ladder up to heaven. He's the one the way, the truth, and the life. And we have him. God is with us. And Jesus, having returned to heaven, has given us his Holy Spirit. And we are indwelt by him. There's nowhere we can go that's not his. There's no relationship that we can be part of that is outside of his knowledge. There's no adversity. There's no unkind word that can be spoken. There's no betrayal that we can experience that he doesn't know all about, that he hasn't experienced himself, that he doesn't have the resources to help us with. We also know that God is out there dealing with other people even while he's dealing with us. I mentioned this briefly, but, you know, there could be another version of the book of Genesis. Almost. We could have the story of Esau here, couldn't we? What happened to him over the last 20 years? Why is it that he comes running and embraces his brother? What's been going on in his life? There's another story there. We're not told what it is. Because Jacob is the one that we're focused on. But apply that then. You know, God is not just working in your life. God is a great chess player. He's more than a great chess player, but he's not less than a great chess player. He positions his pieces very patiently, very carefully, and then when the time is right, he makes his move. And he checkmates. Well, you're one of his pieces, and he works with you to position you, but you're not the only one of his pieces. There's plenty of others, and he positions them, and he works them. And, you know, so often we are fearful, if I speak to this person, what will they say? Well, I believe that if God is moving you and stirring you to speak about somebody, you can bet your life he's been moving them, preparing them, ready to hear. I mean, they might not know that, but you know, God's way ahead of us. You know, the Spirit of God came down into the world on the day of Pentecost, filled the church, but he's come into the world. You know, he's in the world. And he's not going back. He's in the world. He's striving. He's convicting the world of sin. And he's way ahead of his people. He's working in people's lives that you haven't yet met. And whatever. People you don't know. And you know, maybe in 20 years' time, you're going to come across somebody and you're going to find that God has been working in their life and God has been working in your life. And somehow there's a connection and there's a... And you've just got to believe that. And you've just got to be ready to take a risk, which you can do because you're secure. And you can do it because you're free. And you can do it because God has a plan. And so you can share. You can speak. So what I'm trying to say is here, I'm finishing now, finally, at last. You knowing God creates... There's just resources there for a tremendous resilience in life and resilience in relationships. You're in the immortal words of Chumbawamba. I get knocked down, but I get up again. Does Chumbawamba exist anymore? Okay, never mind. Okay. That is going to be the story of your life. If you're a Christian, that's the story of your life. You are going to get knocked down. You are. But you're going to get up again. And do you know why? Because you are united to Christ. And they knocked him down, and he got up again. And they knocked him down, and he got up again. They crucified him. The third day he rose. And his story, you know, is going to be your story. You're united to him. You've been crucified with him. You've been raised with him. That's what becoming a Christian is. Dying to sin, being risen with Christ, with new life, united to him, in him. That's the story of becoming a Christian. It's also the story of living as a Christian. We've got to reckon ourselves dead to sin and alive to God. It's got to be something that we're daily living out and working through. And when you get knocked down, well, okay, I've been crucified with Christ. The world is going to be like that, but I've risen with him. I'm going to rise with him. And I'll tell you, there'll be one day when all the metaphors and all the spiritual reality will blend with physical reality. And one day, just as Jesus was raised, you will be raised. And just as God's people will be raised, creation itself will be raised. That's what we're part of. So I'm going to leave you with two exhortations. Think about that last day, that resurrection day. The first exhortation is, be there. Nothing else matters. You need to be in Christ. Be there. Second exhortation is, bring others with you.